The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Good morning. Welcome to the Free Word Centre. I'm Jonathan Hayward, I'm the director of English Pen. In a few moments, I'll say a bit more about today's event and what we hope to achieve and to enjoy today. But I thought it was appropriate to actually begin with a piece of writing, with a piece of poetry by great contemporary Chinese poet Yang Lian, which he will read in the original, and his translator, Stephen Watts, will then read.
This poem is delicate for Ai Weiwei. Which is an English title, Sunflower Seeds, Lines of a Negation. 一粒葵花籽的否定句,致爱未未.
Unimaginable that Tu Fu's little boat was once moored on this ceramic river. I don't know the moonlight, see only the poem's clarity attenuated line by line to a non-person, to the symbols, discussing and avoiding everything. I'm no symbol, a sun dying under the sunflower seed's hard shell, nor is the sun snow-white collapsed meat of children. Nor have I disappeared, daybreak's horizon impossibly forgot that pain, bones like glass sliced...
Ai Weiwei, he's the sunflower seed artist who's been under house arrest in Beijing for his criticism of the Chinese regime. Next week, publishers from all over the world will converge on London for the London Book Fair. Pride of Place will go to China, with the People's Republic following in the footsteps of Russia, South Africa and India, as the country we'll all be asked to focus on. It undoubtedly makes good business sense to give such prominence to the fastest growing economy in the world, but in artistic and political terms, it's far more controversial. This, after all, is a country that imprisons writers and artists, among them the 2010 Nobel winner Liu Xiaobo, sentenced to 11 years in jail for organising a pro-democracy petition. So the international writers' organisation PEN has mounted its own conference to debate the merits of the book fair's commercial venture, which is called China Inside Out. Richard Lee went along to find out what they were saying.
English PEN has invited writers living in China and elsewhere to explore what life is like for Chinese authors. For the director of English PEN, Jonathan Hayward, the rapid increases in China's political, military and economic power have not been matched by improvements in human rights.
I think life for writers in China is very varied depending on what they write about. Writers who simply write genre novels, romance, crime, thrillers, through certain genres that are very popular, as long as they don't touch on one of the taboo political subjects, life's great. There's a vibrant publishing industry, huge potential market, a lot of interest in e-books. In some ways, it's not a bad place to be a writer. If you choose to write about Tiananmen Square or aspects of the Cultural Revolution, state incompetence or corruption, life suddenly becomes a very different kind of experience.
Because there are writers who are still getting locked up over there now.
There are many writers who are currently locked up in China, I think around 30 at the last count, and to be locked up isn't just a case of being put in some nice, clean, safe prison where you're well looked after and your family get to visit you. It can be being locked up and having the key put in a very mysterious place, people not knowing where you are, your family also suffering intimidation or in some cases being put under house arrest.
And it seems that where the line is drawn is sometimes very arbitrary.
What Marjan was talking about today was fascinating, that if he himself has become taboo, so for him it doesn't matter what he writes about now, it's just the fact it's him writing it is the problem.
But there were promises aplenty after the around the time of the Olympics in Beijing in 2008 that things were going to get better in terms of freedom of expression. Have things got better since then?
No, I think what we at PEN and other free speech and human rights NGOs saw in 2008 should send a very worrying signal to the organisers of London Book Fair and the British Council in 2012. Because if people think that these kinds of big cultural events somehow galvanised the regime to make liberal reforms. What happened in 2008 was the complete opposite. By the end of the year, more writers were imprisoned than had been at the beginning. It seems that the Western attention and the attention of human rights campaigners and activists and pro-democracy campaigners actually hardened the regime. The fear of having to move in response to criticism, the fear of the kind of weakness that that might show to them outweighed any other argument. So they actually began locking more people up rather than fewer.
The arrest of Nobel laureate Liu Xiaobo in 2009 and of the artist Ai Weiwei in 2011 sent a message to writers in China that no one was safe. But it is perhaps the constant surveillance and daily harassment of writers who still walk the streets which is most insidious. The writer Chen Jihua found himself taking the government to court in 2007 after customs officials confiscated copies of his collection of short stories. Things are no better now, he says, as the pressure always gets worse when major political changes are afoot.
For example, recently I've written a book and it's about relationships between China and Japan, and it's also about immigration, Chinese being able to immigrate to other countries. Right now that book can't get published, and that's because the communists are changing their leadership right now.
The poet and cultural entrepreneur Wu Ning is more sanguine, believing that it's possible to work within the Chinese system.
Today we have more space to express ourselves. I think this is a great process in China, the situation. But maybe if some writers trying to challenge the power of the government, maybe they will have some trouble. I believe that is reasonable. Political taboo is quite sensitive.
Are writers in China, or indeed editors like yourself, are they censoring themselves?
Yes, because we still have some topic we cannot touch. If we want our magazine to keep a long life, we still need to be very careful. Otherwise, our investment will be banned in China. That will cost a lot.
Do you think that things are getting better or getting worse in terms of censorship in China?
It's getting better because there's more and more new generation to join the party. Actually, most of them was educated abroad.
With Chinese writers under pressure from a regime which tolerates little dissent, what does this mean for us in the West? Does the official delegation to the London Book Fair omit a vital component of Chinese literature, as some have suggested? Why did English Pen want to organise its own independent conference?
There are some writers who seem able to steer a course where they get the official sanction, and yet they are sometimes challenging and pushing at the envelope a little bit. So what we're doing today here at the Free Word Centre in China Inside Out isn't about something which is purely oppositional. The single most important thing about today's event is that it's not sponsored by the Chinese state. So there is, whatever people actually choose to say on the day, we can be confident they're not saying it because they know it's being listened to, or because their right to return to China may be affected by what they say.
The market focus on China is, of course, intended to bring attention to writers based in the featured country. But can that be a meaningful cultural exchange with China if the invitations are drawn up in consultation with the authorities, indeed with the censors? The translator Julia Lovell argues that the definition of Chinese literature must now be drawn much more widely.
Chinese literature is any literature, I think, written in the Chinese language. I think it's an important point that does need to be written in Chinese. I think that's important to elasticate the definition geographically, certainly to include not just writers working in the mainland, but importantly writers working in Taiwan, because in many respects, in linguistic and stylistic terms, I think Taiwanese writers have actually had something of a head start on their mainland peers, because a modernist movement in Taiwanese literature began that much earlier, around 20 years earlier. It should also include Sinophone writers in Hong Kong, in Singapore, and scattered all over the world.
So who are the writers coming to the UK this year that you're most excited about?
I'm obviously very glad to see established writers who have been writing and working at their craft since the beginning of the post-Mao thaw, so particularly authors like Mo Yan, authors who have already an impressive corpus of literature behind them, showing their commitment to their craft. But I'm also very glad to see younger writers visiting. One author I'm particularly excited about is a writer born in 1976 called Ai Yi, who is a former policeman. And his subject matter is very often crime writing in China. So writing about this very opaque world, the operations of the police, how crime is investigated and so on. So he's shining a light on a part of China that it was very difficult for Westerners and probably also Chinese people who had not been involved in that world to understand.
So are the writers invited by the book fair inevitably compromised? Nikki Harmon, another translator who organised this English Pen conference, thinks that's not right, that engagement in any form gives writers a valuable opportunity.
Oh, I think they'd probably say they can carry on writing exactly as they wrote before. And I think one of the very good things about the events which are happening both before and during and after the book fair is that it will give these people a chance to speak freely on a fairly individual basis to smallish meetings. So they'll have lots of chances to shoot their mouths off and say whatever they want.
So should Western book fairs carry on focusing on countries which don't respect freedom of rights? Is this helping?
I don't think that they do, actually. I think that they, because it's an entirely commercial event, the book fair, my view is that they simply focus on countries where they think the biggest money is going to be made. They're entirely to do with buying and selling rights.
Is it possible, therefore, for writers who are working and living in China now to carve out a space within the kind of difficulties that exist in terms of publication and censorship?
I think we've heard a lot this morning about the difficulties that writers face in China, and I know a handful of writers quite well personally. We've had this conversation many times. It's what they struggle with all the time, to create a creative space which is theirs alone, and some of them are fairly successful in doing that, in that they feel that they're being both creative and independent and they're not starving.
Report by Richard Lee opens up a debate that will undoubtedly grow and grow as China becomes ever more powerful and economically dominant. With me in the studio now is former Observer and Guardian stalwart Jonathan Fenby, who since spent many years in China and has just published his latest book, Tiger Head, Snake Tales, about China today. And on the line from Beijing is our correspondent Tanya Branigan. Tell us about some of your experiences of how writers and artists particularly get on in China at the moment.
Well, I think it's important to put it in context and say that clearly there's a lot more room for expression in China today than there has been sort of 20 or 30 years ago. And that's the thing people sometimes forget. There's actually quite a lot you can say in a way, and that's the striking thing about what happens online and also in the publishing world and so forth, but people are actually able to have quite lively debates. But nonetheless, there are very clearly red lines. There are certain things you really can't talk about. And there are also the grey lines, which are quite ambiguous and perhaps deliberately so, in that they encourage people perhaps to self-censor as well to some extent. So things that we might expect to see published or might not think of as being particularly controversial often find it quite hard to get a hearing. And one example might be, for example, writing about the Cultural Revolution. Now, that is sort of something that you can write or think about, but people often find it very hard to get their work actually published officially. And there's a sense that there's a limit to what the government wants people to say about it. Even though that's something that the Communist Party has described as a catastrophe, it's something they really don't want people to interrogate.
There are some nice stories about the strategies that writers are adopting to be able to tell their stories, like bloggers using the Teletubbies.
Well, people are very, very creative here. I mean, I think this is probably particularly the case for people working or writing online. And in many ways, the internet is actually much more important, I think, in China than it is in the UK as a forum for discussion, precisely because the controls on official publishing houses and particularly on things like television are so strict in comparison that the internet, although it's very heavily censored in some regards, actually becomes much more important because people are having debates there that they can't have in other media. So yes, people find as well, even when there are constraints, they find other ways around them. They're very good at using analogies. Sometimes they have these quite lengthy discussions of these historical figures, which are, of course, a way of referring to sort of current members of the leadership, perhaps. And the Teletubbies, well, this is a classic example where they choose homonyms or partial homonyms to refer to people. So rather than try to refer to Wen Jiabao, who's the country's premier, the Chinese for Teletubby is Tianxi and Bao Bao, so it actually shares a syllable with Wen Jiabao's name, and so they've used that as a way to discuss him. Similarly with Zhou Yong Kong, they've referred to him as Kong Shifu, which is a very popular brand of instant noodle out here. And so it allows them to have these discussions that perhaps they couldn't have otherwise.
Jonathan is smiling and nodding away in the studio. Now, Jonathan, when you were editing the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong in the 90s, presumably things were stricter.
Not in Hong Kong, where there wasn't, you know, still is freedom of expression. It was up to you how far you pushed that. But certainly on the mainland, yes, it was much tighter and tougher. There was much more control. The South China Morning Post, for instance, we were allowed to send a couple of thousand copies across to the mainland, but it was regularly seized, particularly not so much for what you wrote, but for the photographs. If you put a photograph of the Dalai Lama or the President of Taiwan on the front page, bang, that was censored immediately. If you had a cartoon showing Jiang Zemin, who was then the Chinese leader, as a kind of threatening bully over Taiwan, there was a storm over that. But I think probably the greatest change, as Tanya indicates, is there's a greater degree of individual freedom in China, in all parts of life, I'm amazed. And that's one of the themes in my book, how actually the communist regime copes with this increasing personal freedom. But also the internet is incredibly important, and social media, and the way that, although there are supposed to be 30,000 cyber cops patrolling the internet, you can't control social media, the Chinese equivalent of Twitter and so on. And that has introduced a whole new layer of, if you like, freedom of dialogue and expression into China, which I don't think the authorities know how to deal with.
There have been a lot of books about China recently by the Western, what one might call the Western commentariat. I'm thinking of people like Will Hutton, Niall Ferguson, Martin Jakes, whose most recent book is just out in paperback. You think that they're too simplistic in their views. They tend to be either very for or anti.
Yes, I mean, you have to be a bull or a bear on China. You have to be in the school of Chinese-American writer Gordon Chang, who wrote a book called The Coming Collapse of China that came out, I think, 11 years ago, and we're still kind of wondering, you know, is it going to be this year, is it going to be next year? Or on the other hand, you have, you know, Martin Jakes, When China Rules the World. And I think they're both too extreme in themselves. And also, they don't take sufficient account, I think, of all what I call the snake tails, all the little things down on the ground in China. Because China is huge, we all know that. It's the tiger head. It's going to eat our breakfast, lunch and dinner in the years to come. But at the same time, it is tremendously fragmented, China. You know, there are tens of millions of Chinas, in a sense. And I think you have to take that into account. You mentioned Niall Ferguson. It's interesting. I mean, he seems to have gone across the spectrum because he started about, 18 months ago or so, he was arguing China, the 21st century belongs to China. We are the masters now, the Chinese could say. But in his television series that came out in Britain last month, he was kind of saying, you know, will China crash and burn? So we've had a kind of weather vane trajectory there.
Now, you did actually point to a puzzle for me, which was the title of your book a little bit, Tiger Head, Snake Tails.
Yes. Well, that's a Chinese expression. It's basically for a person who comes on very strong, who's very big, but when you actually examine him or her and his or her ideas, you find that it's much more fragmented and on the ground. Now, that's what I understand it to be. When the Taiwanese representative of the publisher, Simon & Schuster, heard of the title, she said, oh, you can't use that title. It's very insulting. They won't like it in China. Well, they probably won't like the book anyway, so it wasn't going to put me off.
Now, your book talks a bit about the kerfuffle surrounding Liu Xiaobo's Nobel win.
Yes.
And Beijing dismissed it as an anti-China interference by a few clowns and called for the ceremony to be boycotted. Mm. And what's quite shocking is that 18 states did, in fact, boycott it.
Yes. many of them quite big trading partners or suppliers to China.
Lots of Arab states.
Lots of Arab states. And then, of course, you saw the Norwegians themselves suffering to some extent through Chinese boycott of Norwegian salmon.
So they did suffer for
They suffered. On the other hand, Statoil, the Norwegian state oil company, went ahead with an agreement with a Chinese oil company to develop oil reserves off Brazil. So it wasn't a complete freeze.
So, Tanya, this is bullying, isn't it?
I think the thing that strikes me more than anything is actually it's completely counterproductive. And that this is the thing I think is so often striking when China attempts to sort of force its message through, that actually it sort of thinks it's defending its interests, and yet I think it ends up doing itself vastly more damage. You know, who was aware of Liu Xiaobo? Even when he won the Nobel Peace Prize, would he really have this kind of profile if the reaction of the Chinese hadn't sort of fanned the flames and kept the story
in the limelight?
And certainly if they hadn't jailed him in the first place for the length of time they did, I think he'd continue to be a not very well-known dissident. I mean, certainly influential in some intellectual circles, but hardly a household name.
Indeed, the chairman of the Nobel Prize Committee said, basically, I paraphrase what he said. He said, we've been wanting to give the prize to a Chinese dissident, a representative of freedom in China, and we couldn't decide who was an appropriate winner. And then suddenly, Liu was thrown into jail for 11 years for advocating democracy, and we had our winner. We had our laureate candidate. So the Chinese authorities, in a sense, gave this to the Nobel Committee on a plate. But I'd agree entirely with Tanya. I mean, there is this great dichotomy in China, contradiction, that on the one hand, China is spending a fortune on attempts at soft power, the Confucius Institutes around the world, CCTV, China is now opening up hugely in the United States, etc., etc., and indeed the London Book Fair is another example of that. And yet, at the same time, from time to time, the heavy, old-fashioned, repressive politics come into play, and that really undermines the soft power. I remember once speaking with the Chinese ambassador in London, who was talking about to a group of journalists about lamenting the fact that people didn't accept and welcome China's soft power and didn't understand the message it was getting over. And after this had been going on for some time, I raised my voice and said, well, you know, when you lock up the Nobel Peace Prize for, you know, for 11 years, that isn't very good for soft power, is it? And there was a long silence.
Now, you've become a bit of a spokesman for the reformism in China, is that correct?
Well,
from your eerie in
London. That's a bit much. But it was an interesting example. When I was in China in March, the main English language state-owned Chinese newspaper, China Daily, which had received an advance copy of my book, they got in touch with me and asked me, would I write a lead comment op-ed article saying why China needed economic reform? And I wrote this, and it appeared under a quite anodyne headline, but exactly word for word as it was. And then it was picked up by other Chinese media. Now, in a sense, this may be getting a foreigner to write something that the paper itself didn't want to write. And then just when the book came out, the end of March, they ran a full-page interview with me, which included this kind of needs for change. So you get the state newspaper commissioning a foreigner to write a piece saying why the state is too powerful in China. I think I'm a tiny, tiny, tiny part of this, but there is actually a debate going on about reform. It's mainly about economic reform, which is in a sense safer to talk about. But as Tanya said earlier on, there are the grey areas where it shades over into political and legal reform and the need for that. Now, cynics will say, we've got a major leadership change in China coming up later this year at the Party Congress, and all this is just smoke and mirrors, everybody, you know, being allowed to vent their opinions to some extent in the run-up to that, and it'll be business as usual afterwards. But I'm not quite sure. I think that, there is a recognition right at the top in China that they can't go on as they have for the last 30 years if they want to continue to grow and develop into the power they want to be.
Tanya, it's all very well for Jonathan opining from London. How what's it like in Beijing? Are you lent on?
I think the point is that as a foreign journalist, really, we have relative freedom to operate, albeit we sometimes find we cannot travel to everywhere that we would like to travel to, that will suddenly, in theory, they change the rules prior to the Olympics, and so we no longer have to request permission to go to places. But sometimes we will try to travel to certain areas and we'll find that they're suddenly blocked and we're not able to go there for some reason due to local authorities. A classic example would be the problems that people have had
in travelling into Tibetan areas to report on the self-immolations we've seen there, although, of course, my excellent colleague Jonathan Watts did manage to get into one of them. But I think the real challenge is that, of course, for Chinese people, they're the ones who face the pressure. They're the ones who face the most serious repercussions. I would say that I think in recent years, particularly last year, we saw increasing pressure on human rights activists, for example, and arguably writers in the last few years have come under increasing pressure. So people who were previously able to travel had more difficulty, particularly in reaction to the Nobel Prize, I think. But also some writers such as, for example, Ma Jian, who's long been a controversial figure on the mainland, but was nonetheless able to visit from the UK and then suddenly found that he wasn't able to get a visa last year when he sought to. So it does seem as if there's been more pressure on people in some regards. Now, having said that, as Jonathan said, we have very recently come to this rather interesting point where there's a lot of talk and a real push for reform in a way there hasn't been previously. Now, whether that will make any headway at the very top of the party, we don't know. And a lot of us are very sceptical. There are a lot of vested interests here. There's a lot of opposition to reform. But nonetheless, we're seeing people talk about reform, particularly economic, but perhaps also political, albeit not the kind of political reforms that many sort of Westerners might expect. It feels as if those things are sort of back on the agenda again. And as Jonathan says, particularly with the leadership transition coming up, people are trying to push those and people are really pressing for them in the mainstream press and the official press, actually, as well as in other fora.
Yes, you've got Wang Yang, who runs Guangdong, the richest province in China in the south, which has been the spearhead of economic development. He, interestingly, I mean, his reform agenda that he puts forward, and this may all be politicking within the Politburo, we can't quite tell, but he does speak of, first of all, economic reform, the need to stop just fixating on crude GDP growth. Okay, you could say it's easy for him to do in Guangdong because they've had the growth, so they can slow down and look for a different model. But then he also extends that to social issues. And what this means is the migrant workers in China, who, of course, a lot of them in Guangdong. And it's not the first generation of migrant workers who worked in all the factories there in the 80s and 90s. They were pretty pliant. They were pretty easy. They just wanted to improve their standard of living, send money back to the village, and eventually go back to the village themselves and open a small business or shop or whatever it is. But their children, who've been born often in these cities, where they have hardly any rights at all. They don't have the right to health service, to education. They can't buy property. They're treated very often as really as second-class citizens. And there have been several violent riots involving them in Guangdong. And Wang Yang is saying, we've got to do something about this social problem. So you then get onto that. And he's also been talking, and Wen Jiabao, the prime minister, has been talking about, you've got to have a better legal system that, quote, serves the people rather than simply serving the party.
Tanya, just bring us up to speed with this big leadership change that's on the cards.
Well, this is the once-in-a-decade leadership transition. And so we're expecting that at the end of this year, probably October, perhaps November, we'll see the next generation of leaders come into power and take over the places in the Politburo Standing Committee, which is the very, very sort of top body in Chinese politics. And so there's, over the coming months, we're going to see a lot of jockeying for position. We're seeing manoeuvring. People are trying to secure their own places and those of their protégés. And it's partly about people and about interest groups, but it is also about policy and this sense that things aren't working in China, that reforms have stagnated and that the current model is not sustainable for lots of reasons, some of which are very excellently explored in Jonathan's book, which I snaffled an early copy of, I'm happy to say. It's really quite an interesting time where people are talking about ideas again and about change, albeit that people are only very cautious, I would say, in their optimism.
I'd say certainly, you know, looking back, I can't remember a period where there was this combination of the personnel change at the top and a debate over the leadership. I mean, you probably have to go back to 1989, really, for that. And I think underlying this is a whole question of, as you rightly say, Tanya, you know, you've got to change the model. They know they've got to change the economic model. That's accepted. You've got to rebalance the economy away from the 1980s model. But how you actually do that and how you implement that, given as you referred to, the vested interests, all the people who are doing very well out of the present system. And again, Wang Yang down in Guangdong, he's been talking about the need to circumvent the vested interests, which include the big state-owned enterprises, people who've profited from the present situation. But then, inevitably, when you talk about that, it may seem like an economic debate, but you then, because of the involvement of the Communist Party in everything, including the economy, you know, every Chinese company of any size has a Communist Party cell in it which has veto power over the business decisions. You get inevitably back to the Communist Party, and therefore you get to the ultimate political question in China: what is the Communist Party for now? Is it simply to deliver material improvement, or is there something else? And since it doesn't have the legitimacy of being elected to government, it's got to find a new legitimacy. And I think, in a sense, you can't say that openly, and no leader will say that, but because the party is all wise, always correct, etc., etc. But that underlies this whole generational discussion that I think is going on in China, overtly or implicitly.
Fascinating stuff. Jonathan, just bringing it back to the London Book Fair, will you be there? Are you going to take part in these discussions?
No, there was apparently talk, my publisher says, of me joining a panel which is discussing the development of China, but there wasn't a seat for me on it.
Oh, that's a surprise.
Although I have written a piece for the Fair magazine. They asked me about, you know, an overview of China. So I'll be there through the written word, but not through the spoken word.
And Tanya, there's been a bit of controversy about the writers that the British Council is taking over. Are you aware of anything? Do you think they've made good choices?
Well, I think inevitably, if you want to work with the state publishers and the state system, you know that there are certain people that they're not going to allow to participate, and that's the decision that the organisers have had to make. I mean, it's very similar to the decision that we saw in Germany a couple of years back with the book fair there, where people were actually disinvited from participation because China said, well, you know, our official delegation's not going to take part in this session if you have these people alongside as well. And of course, again, that was very controversial. And what strikes me most, as I said, is that China's spending this huge amount of money on its soft power drive. As Jonathan said, it's got these Confucius Institutes. It spends insane amounts of money putting up an advert in Times Square on a big screen. And that's really not what soft power is about. Soft power really, it can't be a top-down thing, I think, by its very nature. And so China's desperate to have this cultural power, but I think it's going to find itself that if it wants to do that, it has to allow a greater range of voices, because until it does, people just associate it with exactly the same old practices of censorship and attempts to control anything that's sort of heard in China's name.
Well, this is a conversation that will run and run. Jonathan Venby and Tanya Branigan, thank you very much. Tigerhead Snake Tales is published by Simon & Schuster.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible. Downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.